Good morning.
Oh, yes. Yes, thank you. Good morning again. My talk is about finding the grail, a heart's journey to creativity in clay. And I've got to say that a lot of my talk is going to be my journey to clay. So I hope that's okay. Okay, a little bit. There's the Holy Grail, of course, refers to the cup used by Jesus at the Last Supper. By legend, the cup ended up in England but was lost. The legend continues with King Arthur's court. The knights pursued the grail, which was thought to have healing powers. By analogy, any elusive object or goal of great significance may be perceived as a holy grail by those seeking such. It also can be perceived as a search for God. Being a potter, I was asked by Lynn, I found myself talking about my time with the Grail, a unique and dynamic and spiritual women's organization. It was a formative time in my life, and I'm so grateful to have had the experience. I lived and worked with some of the most incredible women I've ever met. So this talk is about my journey through the 50s and 60s, leading to Grailville, the center for the organization. It's about my time there and how it impacted my path forward toward the arts. I grew up a block away from where I'm standing in the three-story duplex you must be very familiar with. If not, when you leave, look toward 7th Street, past the parking lot, and you will see my old home. We called their parents Aunt Mert and Uncle Keith, even though we weren't related. Our fathers met in college and became friends. In fact, Uncle Keith was the best man at my father's wedding, my parents' wedding. My dad resurrected the family stone company, which lay dormant during World War II, and hired Keith as a plant manager and draftsman. Back then, there were two huge trees in our backyard. Our dad strung a cable that went from tree to tree, supporting a row of swings and a trapeze. They built a tree house, a sandbox, and a rope swing that hung from the tree closest to the house. We could run up the back steps, rope in hand, and jump on it. Every time it swung back toward the steps, another child would jump on. When I was 8, my dad bought a trampoline, a rarity at that time. It was the neighborhood mecca. My parents never turned anyone away unless they were misbehaving. Once my dad counted 14 kids in the backyard jumping on the trampoline, and none of them belonged to either family. I grew up with a lot of love. When I was 9, my grandma and her sister came to live with us for half the year. The other half of the year they spent in California with my aunt's family. There were already 4 boys in a bedroom, and so my parents remodeled the attic. My other grandparents lived a block away on Johnson Street. When I was 10, our 10th sibling was born with cerebral palsy, so severe that living to the age of 28, Bobby never learned to walk or talk. We all took turns feeding and changing him. Bobby learned to navigate the living room by lifting his head with his forearms, leaning his head to one side, and rolling over. My dad would whistle when he came in the door from work, and Bobby would lift his head and laugh. He seldom cried. It was as if we had a mystic in the family. We could only guess his thoughts. Sometimes, fighting about whose turn it was to feed Bobby, we only had to look at him to be brought back to our senses. If we were feeling irritated by being asked to do something for him, the awareness that we could walk, we could talk, we could feed ourselves often lighted our way. I knew deep in my heart that if my parents could love Bobby, they could love me. By the time he turned 18, Bobby was getting too big for us to handle. It was a time before group homes in the local community. He became a ward of the state and lived in Faribault at the state facility. I was driven by curiosity about Bobby. I was drawn to helping less fortunate people, and my ears were open to alternative ways of approaching education. When I was 16, a group of 10 classmates from Cotter High School spent a week in Austin, Minnesota, helping with a summer camp for children of migrant workers run by our diocese. Memory was watching the women make tortillas and heating them outside on a makeshift wood-fired stove. Years later, I found out that Ruben Trejo, one of my art professors at college of St. Teresa, was born in a boxcar. His family had emigrated and moved to St. Paul, and he met his wife, who was then a nun, at a parent-teacher conference where he was a translator for his nephew. I graduated from high school and enrolled in Clark College in Dubuque, Iowa, majoring in elementary education. As a freshman, I did a paper about Maria Montessori. She began her work with children experiencing some form of cognitive delay, illness, or disability. She found so much success with her approach to these children that she wondered how those methods would work on children free of any disability. And as we all know, she found great success. Ideas in education were changing, and the view of students as vessels to be filled were challenged by a vision of active learners. I read books like Summerhill by A.S. Neal. He looked to the inherent goodness of a child. He felt that play led to learning. It was a time of rapid change. The Vietnam War was heating up. My social awareness was intensified as my brothers were contemplating their fates. By 1969, one of my brothers joined the Air Force. Another was drafted and filed 1AO status and was sent to Texas to train as a medic and eventually went to Vietnam. My husband also was drafted and served in Vietnam. They both felt coerced and believed they were fighting an unjust war. Meanwhile, I was participating in anti-war vigils. By the end of my first year of college, I signed up for a two-month program run by the Jesuits in inner city Chicago. The staff was mostly drawn from Catholic colleges. The idea was a convergence of Mexican, Italian, the area was a convergence of Mexican, Italian, and Black families. During our orientation, we listened to a variety of speakers, including the Black activist Jake Jennings, a nun who worked in the infamous Cabrini-Green housing projects, a community organizer who talked about the Alinsky method, a Black mother who lived on the 13th story of a high-rise, and people of Mexican and Italian descent who lived in the neighborhood. We were sent into the housing projects to sign up students. Our students lived in both low and high-rise housing projects. Often the elevators weren't working and people had to climb all those stairs with groceries and little ones. Somehow, escorted by a nun in habit, we felt safe. My job was to tutor elementary students in math and reading in the morning and crafts and films in the afternoon. Each classroom had about 15 students. I loved working with those students. We had field trips twice a week, so the students were able to get out of the area, something they rarely did. We also took them to a camp in Upper Michigan for a week. Little did we know that there would be riots in the area, as it was the summer of the 1968 Democratic Convention. So now my eyes were wide open. I questioned everything. even continuing school. In January of my sophomore year, I signed up for the semester program at Grailville in Loveland, Ohio, just outside of Cincinnati. The Grail has a complex history. In an attempt to clarify what I was told, combined with my own memories, I read the book Women Breaking Boundaries by Janet Calvin, written 25 years after I was there. I knew Janet very well, as I lived in community with her for almost 3 years. The Grail began in Holland in 1921 as an unmarried lay Catholic organization called the Women of Nazareth. It was founded by a Jesuit priest who saw the need for a third option for women in the church besides being married or joining the religious life. But from the beginning, women directed the Grail. What began with college-educated women went on to become a youth movement. There were youth movements all over Europe, including the Nazi youth movement. The Grail staged massive, colorful rallies when the Nazis invaded Germany. When the Nazis came to power in Germany, the Grail had 3 offices in Berlin. The Grail was seen as a subversive organization in conflict with the Nazis. The women burned their membership papers, shut down their offices, and fled Germany. When the Nazis invaded Holland, they again had to destroy membership papers, which they did by tearing them up into tiny pieces and flushing them down the toilet. They fled to other countries. They went to Australia, Indonesia, South Africa, and America. In May 1940, 2 Dutch Grail women, Lidwien van Kersbergen and Joan Overbos, left on the last boat to leave Rotterdam before the German invasion. They came to the United States at the invitation of Chicago's Bishop Bernard Scheel. The bishop had been in Europe before the war and was impressed by the lay movement that he felt was needed in Chicago. There was an American woman from Chicago with the others in Holland named Mary Louise Tully. She was a graduate of the College of St. She was stranded in Holland. She ended up fleeing with a Jewish couple through France, Spain, and finally got to America on a freighter out of Lisbon, Portugal. Though I ended up spending almost 3 years at the Grail, I never met Mary Louise. As she was working with the Grail in Louisiana, I was unaware of who she was or her part in the founding of the Grail in America until I read Janet's book. Incidentally, the Nazis and then Mussolini shut down Montessori schools. They found the schools subversive because they enhanced the person's value as an individual. The Grail women were given property north of Chicago, Doddridge Farm, where they were to prepare for the arrival of 500 orphans from war-torn Europe. The orphans didn't end up coming to Chicago, so the mission changed to becoming a summer camp for inner-city children. The mission of the Grail was to spread the movement to young, educated women, so Doddridge Farm became a kind of entry for young women who came to join the work of the Grail. The Grail women traveled around the country visiting college campuses and other lay women like Dorothy Day, the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. The Grail was very deliberate about being separate from the hierarchy of the church. Though the core group dedicated themselves to celibacy, they didn't take vows like religious orders, as that would tie them to the bishops. The focus was not necessarily to become celibate, but to encourage development of the person, giving women the confidence, the knowledge, and the spiritual base to take their place in the world. Lidwien and Joan realized the one priest stated that the Grail was a place where you would find a woman with a PhD holding an MOP. Eventually, the Catholic Church found other uses for Doddridge Farm, and the Grail was on the lookout for a working farm. They found such a farm on the outskirts of Cincinnati, Ohio. It had been a gentleman's farm, complete with many small houses, several barns, a horse barn, a pigsty, and a large Victorian house. They bought the place with a down payment from a Grail woman, and I believe it was Mary Louise Tully's family from Chicago who provided that down payment. They were no longer obligated to the Catholic Church. They quickly filled the barns with cows, goats, horses, chickens, and everyone participated in farm and domestic chores. They established a bakery, an art studio, a bookstore, and a printing press. Women were encouraged to risk trying new things like milking cows or baking bread. Starting in 1944, Grailville ran a residential program called the Years School. The focus was to develop the individual to be leaders in the lay movement in the church. Liturgy was the focal point of Grail women's lives. They explored scripture and expressed it through song, dance, drama, writing, painting, and sculpture in city centers across the United States. These centers conducted programs on social issues and the arts. In the 1960s, the Grail moved from the Year School for lay Catholics to a broader audience. Their focus veered toward education, and Grailville became a center for conferences and retreats. One barn was transformed into a sacred space for worship. They became very ecumenical, welcoming Jewish and Protestant women. The head of the organization of Church Women United was a Grail member. Another barn became a dormitory and a meeting space for conference goers. The pigsty became an art studio. A new barn was erected for farm work, and the Grail property was eventually managed by a local farmer. The horse barn became a meeting room upstairs and a library downstairs. Then in 1968, the Grail began the semester at Grailville program. In January of 69, I signed up for the semester program. My previous experience opened my eyes to the need for social change, and the semester program at Grailville seemed like another real-world immersion. By the time I attended the semester program at Grailville, the roles of staff members had become more narrowly defined. Just a few women took care of all the cleaning and handy woman who took care of cars and machines. The rest of the staff was involved in office work and or education. The semester program was designed by a group of Grail women led by Patricia Jean Mannion, a sister of Loretto, who was on the faculty of Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Have any of you heard of Antioch? Yeah, it's an interesting place. The semester at Grailville program was a pilot program for Antioch College, integrating the community involvement in college coursework, created to design a model university for the planned community of Columbia, Maryland. I looked up Columbia, Maryland on Wikipedia, and this is what I found. Opened in 1967, Columbia was intended to eliminate racial, religious, and class segregation. Antioch is a unique college in and of itself. It has two sets of campus students, winter and summer quarters and fall and spring quarters. The alternate quarters are designed for either volunteer work through college. The Grail's focus turned to personal growth without a specific religious context. Those attending the experimental semester would be granted full credits from the college they attended. The stated goal of the semester was to explore basic questions of meaning and value for the individual and for society. There were 25 white and 5 black students. Our college tuition was very different, which afforded a more equitable mix of background. For instance, Oberlin had a semester's tuition of 28, and Grailville accepted both. There were 8 staff members, including several artists, women active in social change, including a former Peace Corps volunteer, and women with graduate degrees in education, history, and theology. We lived in farmhouses scattered around the property. We were 8 to a house. We designed our own classes. We did a lot of brainstorming, exploring our interests. With those ideas, learning teams formed. They included everything from the exploration of social justice issues like racism, classism, and sexism, to expression in the arts. The Grail's approach to education was that learning is like eating. If the appetite is lacking, digestion will be poor. Only if the learner is hungry, driven by burning questions, will learning take place. They felt that real learning was emotionally involving. Experiencing a conversation, a book, or an activity demanded a personal response that involved critical thinking. This expression, whether it's another conversation or writing or action, provides a spiral of learning. All of the classes were held in informal settings and always set in circles. There were no teachers as such, only facilitators. For factual information, another class was about folk tales and how they and lessons they taught us and how they related to our lives. My third class was formed around art, so I'm finally getting to art. There was an art studio created from an old pigsty. It included a ceramic area, an area for painting, a fireplace, and a piano. It was where I first learned to hand build with clay and throw on the wheel. And I believe Lynette Power also did, as my brother were there for us at Grailville for a summer, planting a huge garden. I loved working as piano music was being played. Besides the art studio, the basement of one of the barns was filled with looms, and there was a dark room for photography. The Grail had a printing press and a bookstore filled with books and Grail art. The most famous artist was Trina Paulus, who created religious sculptural work. She also wrote a children's book that some of you may know called Hope for the Flowers. We also had clarification groups of 8 which explored our personal and emotional response to all we were experiencing. It trained us in observing group process and developed the communication skills of sending clear messages, checking perceptions, active learning, and resolving conflicts. 2 days of the week, we did volunteer work in the county or in Cincinnati. I worked in the inner city. I was placed with another student at the Findlay Neighborhood Center. We looked at what they had and how we could help. There were lots of sewing machines and no childcare. We devised a program where we set up local women to teach sewing classes. As in Chicago, we walked door to door, recruiting mothers with children to come to the center to learn how to sew while we took care of their children. We ended up with about 10 children. We set up games for them in the community room and took them to places like the local park and the Cincinnati Zoo. It was an explosive time for me. Not only was I given the time and space to look inward, but I was given the tools to express myself in a supportive and safe atmosphere. I felt that the social issues which I struggled with were given clarity. One very strong memory is a whole group gathering where we discussed our personal contribution to the greater good. Was it best to work on social issues like education. There were several professional artists on staff who gave strong arguments that expressing oneself through art brings joy to the self, and that joy spreads to others. Creativity is about making mistakes and learning from them through pain, frustration, and reflection. It's the pearl and the oyster scenario. From reflection flows new ways of doing things. So, no matter what your occupation, using creativity in what you do is possible, and the Grail would say necessary. That discussion was a turning point for me, giving me permission to take art courses and to work as an artist. My work with clay in the art studio brought me both peace and joy. It was meditative and soul-satisfying. I had not had the opportunity to take art courses before this. If you were headed for college, there were requirements of math, science, and language that didn't allow for art courses. I decided to return to my hometown, attend the College of St. Teresa, finishing my elementary education degree with a concentration in art. Upon graduating, I was offered a job on staff at Grailville to develop programs and to create a newsletter. Knowing that I would have access to a wheel and a kiln, I gladly accepted. The first year, I worked with Bob Traer, the first man ever hired by Grailville. He and his wife graduated in religious studies from Carleton College in North spiritual and social programs. The second year, I focused only on art programs. In the fall, I created art classes for the local community. In January, I created an interim program for college students. And in the spring, I facilitated art classes for the semester at Grailville program. By that time, I had a burning desire to continue my education in ceramics. I had backpacked in Montana during my college years, and I loved it. I found through the Ceramic Monthly magazine that the Archie Bray Foundation, an international mecca for potters, was located in Helena, Montana, and there were strong ceramic departments in three of the major state universities. Although I began my classes at the University of Montana Valley, she had built a wood-fired kiln and worked in an old log cabin. After a year, I moved to Missoula and helped form an artist cooperative and gallery. I met my husband, got married, and set up another studio on a rental property. We bought land and set up yet another studio, building kilns brick by brick at each place. In 1979, I moved back to Winona and continued pottery until our fourth child was born. I found art fairs and the life of a potter very difficult with small children. Since I had a teaching degree, I began a teaching career that lasted for 25 years. I did not want to teach art, as that required seeing way too many students in a day. I wanted to really get to know each student, incorporating as much hands-on and experiential learning as I could. The third grade teachers were notorious for the many field trips we took. I was able to get back into pottery part-time as my children left home, and full-time once I retired. There is constant learning in ceramics. I find myself in the spiral of curiosity and experimentation, leading to the ecstasy and sometimes the agony of a completed firing. I applied for and received two grants, one from the Southeastern Minnesota Arts Council and another from the State of Minnesota Arts Council. I find much joy in introducing people to clay and sharing what I know with others, but honestly, the greatest joy for me is in my quiet work, getting lost and found in clay. Though much property has been sold off, Grailville still does exist. Some Grail members work as individuals in concert with already existing social justice organizations. Some live and work in a small community in small community houses in 103 communities across the 26 states. They have worked with the civil rights movement, the war on poverty, the United Farm Workers, the women's movement, the Southern Consumers Cooperative, and so much more. As you can see, much of the GRAIL's work has really concentrated on social justice. The GRAIL currently exists in 21 countries on 6 continents. The GRAIL acts as a consultant for the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women, annually hosting women from all 21 countries. Thank you.
Yeah, no, you can just...